If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the Legends Lounge. I'm Trill Withers, and with me in the lounge today, we have former Notre Dame Fighting Irish. She was an all-star, as well as a two-time champion with the Detroit Shock. And she is a current studio analyst, slash some of everything from what I'm understanding with the Miami Heat. We have Ruth Riley Hunter with us. Ruth, thank you so much for stopping by the lounge.
Hi, it's great to be on.
Of course, of course. First things first, I always like to ask people, what was your welcome to the league moment?
Welcome to the league. Wow, you're taking me back here. You know, a few things. For the WNBA, it's unique, right? Because we're finishing up finals as we're starting training camp. And so I just remembered that, you know, like leaving as, you know, all my friends were finishing up their finals and heading into senior week, and I was heading to two-a-days down here in Miami. But I think on the court, it was probably the first time starting, playing against Lisa Leslie, you know, the best to ever play in my position. And as a rookie coming in and remembering what that moment was like and what that challenge was like and how different that was than what I experienced on a collegiate level.
Did she, if you remember the game, did she hurt you too bad, like you guys' first meeting?
Yeah, I mean, look, she's one of the best to ever play. So I do remember being humbled. And, you know, in college, too, I mean, post play is so different. Back to the basket, right. It's different even now than when I was a collegiate player. And once you got to the pros, I mean, just they're so skilled and facing up and navigating through double teams and – I just remember, wow, I have a lot to learn.
So when would you say you felt like you first belonged? Like maybe things are first starting to click or slow down for you?
I think once I busted into the starting lineup, that gave me the confidence to feel like, okay, I know I was a high draft pick. I know that I came off a national championship and collegiate player of the year. And none of that really matters on the next level. You really have to prove yourself all over again. And I was very fortunate to be drafted to Miami to play for Ron Rothstein, who is, you know, a legendary coach. Not only the original Heat coach here in Miami, but so many assistant coaching stints in the NBA. So he brought just a wealth of knowledge. So really taught me the game on a professional level. And I feel like once he felt confident to put me in that starting five, you know, that was the first step that I felt like I really belonged.
Gotcha. Gotcha. We'll go back even a little bit further, not too much further. You were raised in Indiana, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I ask this with all due respect. When was the first time you heard on the court that white girl can play? Because I know you've heard it.
You know what? It was more of just I was the only girl playing, you really? Know, like, I mean, growing up, I was a girl with all the guys, and you knew when the pickup games were, you know, every Sunday they were in this gym, every Wednesday they were in that gym. And so I was fortunate to have older male cousins that kind of brought me along, and then I had to learn how to hold my own. But growing up in Indiana, I mean, everyone has a hoop, right? On every barn, every light post, anything that's 10 feet tall, you're going to throw a basket up there. And I mean, it's a difference. It's really different when you see basketball in the state of Indiana. And I'll say this too, like my high school, even our elementary school has two gyms. And in high school, I mean, some of the gyms I played in, our auxiliary gym was better than our gyms I played in overseas. You know, like it's a different level of hardwood and hoops in Indiana.
Definitely. So you went to Notre Dame, as I mentioned, but like you grew up in Indiana. I imagine that wasn't too hard of a sell?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, you hear a lot more about, in basketball, you heard a lot more about IU, Bobby Knight, you heard about Purdue, you have so many, I think of, you know, kids that I went to school with, their parents went to one of those two schools. Not many of my peers' parents went to Notre Dame. And so while there was a lot of love for Notre Dame football, I think, you know, most of the state schools were kind of where people's allegiances lied for basketball. But once I started the recruiting process, I mean, Notre Dame was really like it for me. I knew right away that's exactly where I wanted to be.
What was it about it? Because like they were looking back, you know, it's always been Notre Dame, but they weren't, you know, two-time champion Notre Dame when you went there. Hall of Famer or future Hall of Famer Muffet McGraw wasn't future Hall of Famer Muffet McGraw yet. So what was it that got you there?
You know, it was a few things. I knew I wanted to go to a smaller school. I've never, you know, I grew up in the country. There's 82 kids in my class. I knew that I didn't want to go to a large state school. I wanted to go to somewhere where I was a part of building something, and Notre Dame was on the rise. The year, my senior year after I committed, they got to the Final Four that year for the first time. And, you know, academics is something that was ingrained in me at a very young age. And I wanted to go to some school that was like strong in academics, strong in athletics, but faith is something very important to me as well. So that intersection of community, of doing good in our world, and of pursuing excellence in all that we do, Notre Dame checked all those boxes.
So it sounds like it was a short recruiting process.
I didn't really take any other official visits. I mean, I was really shy too. So the thought of like going, I mean, the recruiting process was painful. So I was good.
Okay. So you get to Notre Dame, 4 years there, you know, All-Americans, Player of the Year, Defensive Player of the Year, the championship. Of all the accolades, all the memories, what stands out? Like, what do you think about the most, like even now?
You know, I mean, it really is hard to top winning a national championship. And to walk off the court the last time I wore a jersey that said Notre Dame, and to know that my last collegiate game ever was winning a national championship for a school that I loved, in front of my family and friends, for a student body that supported us in a way that women's basketball was just starting to get supported.
You know, and their first women's first championship. So you like that, that's on the resume forever.
Yes. Yeah. The first time hanging that banner. And so that was definitely something special.
Definitely. So after that, you were top five pick, you got to the Miami Soul, as I mentioned. What was that like just culturally for you? As you mentioned, you grew up in Indiana all your life, shy personality, and now you're in Miami. So what was that like, that transition?
It was unique.
I mean, in what way?
South Bend to South Beach, right?
Yeah, that's quite the transition.
That's for most people, that's a one-way ticket too. I mean, you're not coming back.
No.
You know, I think I was very fortunate, even though I grew up in a very kind of sheltered childhood, I would say, lack of diversity in some sense in Indiana. My mom raised me to be incredibly open-minded and to embrace seeing the world, what the world had to offer. She traveled a lot before she had us. And so I think that I was excited at that point. I felt like I was ready. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or just curious. I think curiosity is something, you know, I talk to young girls a lot about, like, just being curious about the world around you is a tremendous asset. And so, and you're just excited. I mean, it really didn't matter at that point, right? Whoever is drafting you and giving you an opportunity to live out your dream, you just can't wait to get there.
It just doesn't hurt when it's in
South.
Yes. It never hurts.
I'm still here, so yeah, I think there, it worked out well.
Exactly. Now, you get there, you come off the bench early. Was that the first time in your life you'd ever come off the bench?
First time since junior high.
Yeah, let's say first time in a while. Maybe.
Yes.
What was that like for you?
You know, I think, you know, it was different in the sense, but I knew you know, I think I have a pretty honest assessment of who I am as a person and as a player. And so I didn't come in thinking that anything was going to be handed to me. I've always earned everything through my work ethic and devotion to the game. And so I didn't expect that to be any different when I got to the pros, but it's humbling. It's a start over. Definitely. To be at the top of your game and to start all over and to look up and to realize you have a lot to learn and all over again. So that was definitely humbling.
Yeah. So by the end of the year, like you mentioned, you got into the starting lineup, but then going into year two, you get injured. What was that your first time being injured? Like seriously injured?
Yeah, I mean, the ton of ankle sprains and the normal injuries, but the first time, and the W season's so short. Right. So any injury during the WBA season,
like
just
a couple weeks is just,
Yeah, it's like a fourth of the season right there. Right. And so I had spent the entire off season training. I felt good. I worked out here with our coaches, you know, felt like I was primed to really take that next step. And, you know, as most athletes experience injury, I mean, it's adversity that you have to overcome physically and mentally.
Hmm. What did you think was hard, like the physical part or the mental part? I feel like I've heard athletes say both.
I think not being able to play, you know, is hard. Not being able to be out there on the floor and to help your team and to be a part of what's going on, I think is the hardest part for me.
Right. And after year two, they have the dispersal draft because the Miami Soul folded. What do you remember about just that entire process?
That was crazy.
I bet.
I remember finding out in the off season I was playing in Spain, I think at the time, and just for the first time, it didn't cross my mind that.
Yeah, did you have like any idea?
Yeah, nothing.
Wow.
No. You know, so like that, I think that in some way is really what propelled me to take a leadership position in our players union and to really understand the business side of our sport, to understand for the first time that there's no guarantees, that we as players have to be active participants in growing this league. That even though, you know, this organization treated us incredibly well and, you know, is here for 2 years, there's a reason why that didn't work out for them at that time. And so I think that opened my eyes and really allowed me from early on in my career to understand how our league is structured, our contracts, you know, the business side, how do we get more fans in the stands? How do we get marketing deals that are sustainable? Like all those things that you really wouldn't normally think about as a player.
Right. So you get to go from Miami to Detroit. Leaving warm weather for Midwest, what was going through your mind then? Was it good to get back to home or you like, I kind of got accustomed to these 80 degree December days?
Well, the beauty of it is the W is just during the summer, right? So Detroit in the summer is actually not a bad place to be.
That's true. if you're gone by winter, then
yes.
Yeah, so that's fair.
But I was, you know, like I was really fortunate. I mean, obviously that first year in Detroit won one of our first championships and to go to a place where I can really just took tremendous growth in my game, to play with amazing women who, you know, just you love taking the floor with. And so sometimes it's just fit, right, in this league, and you got to find the right situation, the right coaching staff that sees and believes in you and that mix of players that bring out the potential in each other. And so I loved my years in Detroit.
So recently we talked to one of your old assistant coaches. We talked to Rick Mahorn. What do you remember about Coach Mahorn?
Well, I mean, it's unique to get coached by the Bad Boys, right? Yeah. I mean, Bill and Rick obviously have a ton of history together. I mean, their relationship is unique in itself. So I think that Rick balances out Bill in a way that's much needed.
that makes sense, but it's also kind of terrifying that Rick Mahorn is the one that's doing the balancing.
This is true. Yes. a lot of stories from those two. But I think what you also pull is just their experience. They treated us, they knew what professional basketball was. And for a league that was just starting to understand the difference between women's collegiate basketball and what professional basketball could and should be on the women's side, you needed men to really bring over their experience. And, you know, kudos to Coach Ron, to Rick, to Bill, to, you know, to see beyond gender and just to see the game itself, and to be able to relay their experiences to us and allow us to be the best that we could be. And, you know, there's a handful of other men who have done that as well.
For sure. What would you say, like, the biggest transition? You mentioned, you know, the game, just getting used to, like, the collegiate game to the pro level, those transitions. What would you say was the biggest one, or maybe even the toughest one for you?
Well, I think there's a few things. I mean, just the physicality itself, the skill level. Obviously, you go playing against the best 20 to 21 year olds, and now you're playing against the best women in the world. Right. Like,
grown women, right.
But for me, just the evolution of my game, you know, when I got to Detroit, Bill played me a little bit as his position in kind of that old Detroit offense, more of a face-up facilitator, which is a role that I never played in college. And so, you know, it was stereotypical back to the basket post player. And so just learning how to see the game different, how to read the game different, you know, a lot more pick and roll actions or off ball sets that you just don't run in a collegiate offense as well. Hmm.
Did you prefer that side of it? Like going, or were you still like at my core, I still back to the basket?
Yeah, I love to learn. I think, you know, even now just watching skill development, like watching our guys put in the work and what they're working on and how that plays out and how that changes the dynamic of the game and their ability to create an advantage. And then how do you defend that? You know, right. I just love all of those pieces coming together. So as a player, as much as I can learn and add to my skill set, I always embrace that opportunity.
Hmm. Now, earlier you mentioned you played in Spain. You've played also like the WBL. Played in the WNBA offseason. You played a couple seasons with the Colorado Chill. What do you remember about that experience?
You know, it was unique. At the time, my priority was to be available for USA Basketball, to be available in their training sessions. And that's hard to do if you're overseas, and you know, a lot of overseas teams aren't going to give you those outs in your contract. So thankfully, there was a very small and not high-budget league going on here in the States. But I also played in Colorado. It was a great situation. I played with Becky Hammond and a lot of the Colorado State and Colorado former players. And so it felt in some ways like a collegiate setting again, you know, just pretty laid back. They didn't have the same pressure. You just kind of go out there and get your reps in the off season. And you got to work on things, aspects of your game, and maybe a less pressured environment too. And had the opportunity to stay here in the States and continue to train, which was my, you know, my ultimate goal.
Right. You talk about getting that call from the Olympics, which you did for the 2004 Olympics. What was it like getting that call, I guess?
It's one of the most memorable calls I've ever received. And
who calls? Who, like, talk us through, like, the whole process.
You know, I mean, Carol Cowan was the head of USA Basketball for the longest time. She just retired this year. And so she was the one that, you know, called, and I just, you know, I can see it now. I was in Detroit. I was in the hallway of the palace, and I got the call, and just, you know, my dream as a little girl was to play in the Olympics before the WNBA, before I even thought about even competing in college. You know, that was the dream that I had. And so just that realization that I had now had the opportunity to live that out. And there's no greater honor than representing your country.
And you get to do it with Swing Cash, who was your teammate at the time, but also the aforementioned Lisa Leslie, who welcomed you to the league, I should say. So what was it like going, you know, from in a couple of years now, your peers, like y'all are side to side overseas representing the country? What was that like?
You know, I share this story a lot when I talk with young athletes, because rarely are you ever really happy about the role that you have on a team, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone wants something more, something different. And so we just came off in 2003 that we won a title with Detroit. We beat LA. Mm-hmm. I was the MVP of that finals, going up against, battling against Lisa Leslie. And now, fast forward the next summer, you know, I'm living out my dream, but my job on the Olympic team was to prepare Lisa to compete against whatever team, you know, that we were competing against. And right. So that's the reality of that role. And, you know, we had a young team, Swin, Sue, myself, Diana Taurasi, Yolanda Griffith. I mean, our second unit was really, we weren't going to get a ton of minutes. And that's right. Just the reality of, you know, having a veteran-led USA team. And so, you know, to be humble enough to recognize what that role is, but also to recognize there's real significance and purpose in that, and to really embrace that, was my experience on the Olympic team. Hmm.
Was it I guess, were they honest with you about, like, they let you know, like, hey, just so you know, it's going to be mostly, you know, backup minutes, we're going with the vets, or... I guess I had you. Was it communicated to you?
I think you just know. I mean, when you look up, I mean, like, if you have any self awareness and you have, you know, Tina, Lisa, Cheryl,
right,
Dawn. I mean, there's
Hall of Famers.
Like, yes, yeah. Like, there's a reality there of. Right. I mean, and they've been leading, and that was probably maybe their fourth Olympics at that time, or third. So, yeah, I mean, you knew, especially as one of the youngest players coming in, that, you know, like, which is what I was, like, that was real. But you also have to be ready, right? Because you never know when your number is going to be called. And right. So I think that's the challenge, the unique challenge of that position.
Just staying ready.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in addition to studio analyst, champion, you're also an author, color commentator, you're the vice president of the WNBA Players Union. Am I missing any hats you've worn? you're on the Presidential Council for Physical Fitness, I saw. What am I missing? I don't want to sell you short.
You know, I've just been blessed. I mean, there's so many avenues this game takes you. And I think, A, being open and creating space in your schedule for those, and recognizing, you know, what you're passionate about. For me, it was to be the best version of myself on the court, but to make sure I was using the platform of sport in a meaningful way. And so I always, every year, wanted to make sure that I was creating opportunities to travel, whether it was with the State Department, you know, using that platform of sport in partnership with some of our, you know, NBA Cares nonprofits, with Nothing But Nets, with No Kid Hungry, you know, things that, you know, were important to me, and programs and initiatives that I was really passionate about, and also giving back to the next generation. And so that's something that I feel very strongly and always felt very strongly about.
So you knew there was something, like, even before you started playing professionally, you knew you wanted to give back in some way.
I think Notre Dame taught me that early on, you know, mm-hmm. like they show you that intersection of sport and platform, and every athlete has the opportunity to opt into that, right? Like, right. We can all be athletes with good intentions, but if you don't create space and really make it happen, at the end of the day, you're going to look back and say, what? I wanted to do good.
Yeah,
and
I think.
So I think early on, I was very mindful of, I didn't want to have just good intentions. I wanted there to be actions behind it.
Now, of all the roles I mentioned, some I apologize, I'm sure I missed a few. What would you say, what was the toughest for you? Like, outside of basketball, what was the toughest, I guess, post-playing career thing for you to either adjust to or get a handle on?
You know, that's a great question. I think as a player, the toughest was definitely the vice president of the union, like, off the court, you know, like, negotiating those CBAs and trying to really do what's best for the entirety of the league. And to not feel like, honestly, you have a ton of leverage at that point, right? Like, because we're still building this.
It's a very young league at that point.
Yeah. Yes. I think I was very fortunate. I knew when I was done playing, I was going to go back to grad school, and I just feel like going back to get my master's at Notre Dame gave me that buffer of transition. I think a lot of athletes, when they've done, they're searching for what's next. And I knew that what's next was taking me to grad school. I didn't know exactly what I would do after that, but I think that made that transition a lot easier for me.
Right. Now, you mentioned Nothing But Nets, No Kid Hungry, some charitable organizations you've been a part of. At the time people hear this, you have just had an event in February. Tell us a little bit about that if you can.
Yeah, I've talked with the Heat organization, and you know, they're really passionate about connecting with young female athletes in our community. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've just been brainstorming, what can that look like? What should that look like? And for me, I knew that had to be something different. And so what I came back to them with was, let's do a hoop lab. Let's take the top junior high and the top high school athletes, invitation only, and let's really break down the game in a different way. You know, you can get hundreds of kids in the gym and just work them through drills, but I wanted them to feel confident, empowered. I wanted them to feel valued that we saw them, but I also wanted them to understand the game. So what we do is we take them into the lab, what we call, we break down video as you would on a professional level. So we take a skill set, we break it down, teach them how to see that in the game themselves, right? I think self-awareness is something that we don't talk a lot about.
Right.
And we don't teach young athletes how to be self-aware of things that they're trying to grow in their game. And then we take them on the court and we do kind of progressive skill development from there. And then, you know, obviously we let them play, which is fun for them as they get on the Heat practice court here.
Do you ever jump in there? Like every once in a while jump in like the games, and like really give them what's what a kid get too mouthy and you just have to remind them who you are every once in a while?
I haven't done that lately. Usually, you know, when I do camps, I will do like, I'll let them play one-on-one. And so, you know, they get, you know, the chance to just attack the rim and, you know, and see if they can score, which I think is a fun drill for them. And I do, I still, my nephew's a freshman in high school. So I have a longstanding one-on-one game with him, which he has not won yet, but I'm afraid that day might be coming soon.
Okay. So at that point, are you, and be honest, are you thinking about like, you know, elbows, you going dirty, or maybe you've been playing dirty the entire time?
I played in Detroit.
You played for Lambeer and Rick Mahorn. What was I thinking?
He's probably a better. Well, once he becomes a better shooter, that's where it gets tough. He can't guard me if I back him down and shoot over the top. So that's just not going to happen yet.
Right. But it's mouse in the house until he does.
He's growing fast though. When I see him, you know, a couple times a year, I'm always surprised.
Yeah, so you got to get those last couple of victories in while you can.
Exactly.
we won't take too much more of your time. When did you know it was time to hang him up?
I felt like my body was telling me, and you can go on. And I knew I could play more of a mentor role, and I embraced that, especially with young players. You know, just being around and being a positive influence. But I also knew that I couldn't play to the level that I wanted to be able to compete at. And I knew I wanted to go back. There would be a next chapter. And so, you know, I was looking forward to going back to grad school and to continuing on to see what that next chapter was like.
I also like to ask, who were some your veterans, when you first, either with Miami, Detroit, whoever, who were some of your veterans that either kept you in line or had you getting donuts or whatever it may be?
You know, I mean, we had a unique mix of players in Miami because it was formed with a dispersal draft. So we had some, you know, European players. I mean, two of our bigs were from Russia and from Germany. So it wasn't kind of that normal vet.
Right.
Experience that they were playing in a WNBA for the first time as well. And then Detroit, we were just the youngest team in the league. I mean, we were all just running and gunning, like early 20s.
Right.
So I would say I never thought about it, but I didn't have that unique career. I mean, Sandy Brondello, who's the coach now for Brooklyn in the WNBA, she was probably the vet that took me under her wing here when I got drafted to Miami and helped me understand, I mean, you know, the ultimate professional, just watching her work and how she went about her craft.
I was gonna say, yeah, what does that look like? Is it distinct, you know, one-on-one sessions, or is it more of just kind of watching, you know, how a professional goes about it?
I think watching how they go about it, but also, you know, getting in the gym with them, right? And you know, getting the reps in.
Seeing hard they work and
the recovery too. I mean, that's come a long way since when I came into the league, but just, you know, that was something new, right? Like ice baths and recovery and all that stuff. That was different.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like you caught a pretty good era. Of course they've got it better now, but I feel like you caught a decent, where they were starting to kind of understand it. They're like, okay, yeah, maybe ice on your ankles and maybe it's a good thing.
Or a Theragun. I was like, man, if it would have had one of those.
Still be playing. You still be out there.
Something.
Do you remember how much your first check was for the first time you got paid for playing basketball?
I don't. That's a good question. I don't.
Okay. Do you remember what you bought with it? Did you buy anything crazy?
I don't think it was enough to buy anything crazy.
A nice dinner or something?
I think, you know, actually, I mean, going from, you know, the per diem checks that we got in college, now I can actually, I think probably, you know, getting some outfits, going to the mall. I mean, that was very simple, I'm sure.
Gotcha. And what would Ruth now tell Ruth at around 18? Like what advice or what tidbit would you tell her?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, 18 going into college. I think I just see the game so differently now, right? And so, you know, with 20 plus years of experience and understanding what skill development could have been, you know, we didn't have that breakdown of the shooting and positionless basketball and understanding the game. I mean, I love seeing it now. And I would have loved to been a part of that, the system that we have now. And so I think I would have just challenged myself to see the totality of the game in a different way.
There it is, Ruth Riley Hunter. Thank you so much for stopping by the lounge.
My pleasure. And thanks for all that the Retired Players Association does. I mean, shout out to you guys for all that you do, connecting us, all that you provide for us, to making us feel like we're a part of, you know, that brotherhood and sisterhood that we had as players. And so just know that that we are grateful for all that you do.
Oh, likewise. And know you got an open seat here in the lounge anytime.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon, Ruth.
Bye.
All right. Thank you for stopping by the Legends Lounge, brought to you by the National Basketball Retired Players Association. Give us a follow on Twitter at NBA Legends Lounge and be sure to subscribe and rate the Legends Lounge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll catch you next time. I don't know.